Hey, everybody. It's Open Call. I'm Chris Grace.
And I'm Eric Michaud.
And we're back. Episode 2. Thanks for coming back.
You've made it this far. Episode 2.
Yeah.
Look at the dedication.
Thank you to us for coming back.
Look at the... That's I'm touched.
That's right.
I really can't talk.
As you know, this is a... last time we said it was about musical theater, but I actually think it's about theater in general.
No.
Because then we can talk about plays and stuff.
No.
What if we see a play we want to talk about?
We won't.
The Humans is coming to Pantages.
That's true. No, I'm open to talking about plays as well.
We're going to see Harry Potter in New York at some point.
Uh-huh. At some point. We have tickets already.
Yeah. I'm just saying, that doesn't have music in it. And I can't start a separate podcast to talk about plays.
That's true.
That's too many podcasts, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You don't want to say anything about that?
No, it's fine. Yeah.
Let's talk about news.
Okay.
So Eric is much more on top of news with musical theater than I am. Or theater.
Just theater.
So Eric can keep us updated, and then I can ask questions because I don't understand a lot of these things.
First of all, a new show just opened. I can't remember where it opened. I think it's Barrington Stage, which is the Royal Family of Broadway, which is William Finn's new musical.
One of my favorite composers.
Uh-huh. Based on the play The Royal Family, which was kind of a 1927, 1928 show kind of
skewering. Like William Saroyan? Kind of like...
Kind of skewering the Barrymore, so it was about the... Yeah.
Okay.
So it stars Harriet Harris. The reviews that I read were very positive for the most part. It's the same team that kind of helmed, and it's where Spelling Bee started as well. So another mm-hmm. William Finn show that eventually transferred to Broadway. So it's quite possible that given the favorable reviews that this show will go through some retooling and end up on Broadway in the next season or two.
Harriet Harris is playing like an analog of who? Like the matriarch of the Barrymore mm-hmm. family, kind of? Mm-hmm. Harriet Harris was played the racist part in Thoroughly Modern Millie.
I was going to say it's not Asian, but yeah, okay.
She played an Asian woman in Thoroughly Modern Millie. I like her though. Is she the one that was in Phantom Thread?
Yes.
Oh yeah, I love her.
The drunk
and yes, love her.
Yeah, she's playing the lead. She her notices were very very good. There was a couple of little quibbles I saw in the reviews that I've read. Terry Teachouts was very positive in the Wall Street Journal, but there was another that mentioned that the score is a little evasive, or not evasive, just a little hard to latch onto in places.
Elusive,
I guess. There are apparently some huge. Like crowd pleasing numbers that just get extended applause that the audience is going nuts for, but then there are other songs that are kind of a little need work, I guess is what you'd say.
William Finn is wrote the score. Who wrote the book?
I don't know.
Oh,
I
or any other parts of it? Lyrics?
I don't know.
Eric's going to keep us up to date.
Now
on
I
want to
start over.
No, we're not going to start over. why don't you? I'll talk about William Finn. William Finn, I liked ever since Falsettos. I had a cassette tape of Falsetto Land back in the day when it was like three separate musicals.
A show that I do not like.
Eric does not like.
It's blasphemy.
Eric does not relate to anything homosexual.
except for you.
Yeah. No, I liked it a lot. Falsetto Land, I loved. And then they put them together. It was In Trousers, March of the Falsettos.
That's right.
March. Now I'm derailed. Anyway, they put the three of them together, and it was just called Falsettos. And that was with Michael Rupert. I can't remember where I saw that. Maybe like Playwrights Horizons or something like that. I remember at some point Mandy went in for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then
he did the Broadway production. He replaced.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because it was up for, and then they just brought it back last year,
right?
With Andrew Rannells and basically a bunch of non-Jewish people playing Jewish people.
There was a lot of uprising, well, not uprising, but a lot of
non-Jewish people playing Jewish people.
To go back to your original questions, there, Rachel Scheinkin wrote the book for Royal Family of Broadway.
Okay, she wrote the book for Spelling Bee.
Yeah, music and lyrics is William Finn. It's directed by John Rando and choreographed by Joshua Burgas. So,
John Rando, I know the name somewhere, but I like the name Rando because what a Rando. Rachel Scheinkin, I will recommend another podcast, which is the Broadway Backstories podcast. If you listen to the backstory, like history of Spelling Bee, they did a very tough thing with Rachel Scheinkin, mm-hmm. which is that she was in Spelling Bee originally.
Oh. Right. Back when it was like Crepuscule or whatever it was called.
Yeah, Crepuscule on the east side, and had to like at some point be like, you. At least I think it was her. Did she direct it too?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't. No, no, no.
James LaPine directed it. At one point, they had to just go to her as one of the creators of the show and say, like, you don't sing well enough to be in this show.
Boom, boom.
And then they gave her, like, a little bit of time to, like, go get singing lessons and try to come up to the right level. And they were just like, no. And it was interesting. Like, it's a very candid and tough decision to take, but probably helped the show, overall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's probably had a richer creative life because she was able to accept that decision, but right. Also must be very hard to hear.
Yeah. John Rando, just going back, because you'd mentioned his name, he directed You're in Town, the original production. He
right, that's right.
Yeah. Directed Dance of the Vampires.
Which you loved. Saw multiple times.
I never said that I loved that
but
show.
But how many times have you seen it?
I saw it 3.5 times.
And how many performances did it have?
More than 3.5. It ran for like 3.5 months.
But if we made a list in the world of all the people in the world, and we made a list of the number of people that saw that production of Dance of the Vampires, you'd be up there.
I would be up there. Also, I sat in on a rehearsal once.
Oh, that's right.
My ex was working for a press agency that was working for, or was doing the press for Dance of the Vampires. So we sat in on a rehearsal and watched them trying to stage the Red Boots Ballet, the whole kind of ballroom scene. I remember thinking, oh my God, this looks crazy in the rehearsals. And thinking, oh, they're going to fix it. They're going to fix it. And then I was like, no, they're not going to fix it.
And then you thought, I'm going to come see this 3 more times.
Well, because every time I saw it, even after it opened, it was different. Like, there was one particular number, Carpe Noctem, where it was significantly different all 3 times I saw it.
Oh.
Like, the costumes changed, the wigs changed, people were in different places, choreography changed, the intent changed.
Carpe Noctem, seize the night? Oh, Lord. So when something shows up at Barrington, how long is the process typically when it hits Broadway?
Usually a couple of years. Okay. I mean, if it's a gigantic, like if it's something like The Producers, you know, which obviously didn't start at the Barrington, but if it was something of a juggernaut like that, where it was like, we have to bring it now, it can transfer in a few months generally.
So is there something noteworthy about this production as opposed to other, cause I assume Barrington is doing stuff all year.
Yeah. The fact that it's the same team that brought the revival of On the Town, that brought Spelling Bee to Broadway. It's a lot of the same creative people who did that. So it seems like we're putting our best foot forward. We're going to fast track this. We're going to try to move this to Broadway. And the favorable notices, again, mm-hmm. are kind of an indication of this seems ready. One of the reviews mentioned that it could be considered a critic-proof show. It's so funny and it's so much fun to watch that the audience was just going crazy, and that word of mouth is going to be great for this show.
Yeah.
So I, for one, am excited. I love a new musical, and I love when the source material isn't a film that came out 7 years ago. So I'm happy to see something a little bit different.
Since all the Tony nominated musicals this year were based on movies.
Right.
Like pretty recent movies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the coming years, we have Pretty Woman coming in. We have Tootsie coming in. There's a lot of King Kong film adaptations coming in still.
I can't wait for Dunkirk, the musical.
Mm-hmm.
Ready Player One, the musical.
Hurt Locker, the musical, that was supposed to run.
Mm-hmm. We saw a different show. We went to see Hurt Locker, the musical, and a totally different show was in the theater instead.
It was so weird.
Yeah, it was weird. What else is coming down the pike?
There's just announced another kind of lab production of Clueless, which has been long gestating.
I was just thinking I need to see another musical about teenagers.
With 3 teenagers as the leads.
Oh, yeah. Is it the same? Is it 3 girls that are like a clique?
Here's the thing that I've been thinking about with Clueless. First of all, it's the same situation as Mean Girls. Heather's was first. Mm. They did it better. They did it well. And the problem I find with both Mean Girls and Clueless is the way that Heather's was restructured for the musical, having been that Veronica was an outsider. She was kind of a nerd at the beginning of the show and then transformed into one of the Heathers, rather than already being a Heather and already being wealthy and already being one of that clique when the show starts,
right,
is what essentially Clueless is. It's 3 popular girls who find the Brittany Murphy character, who's like, she's a mess. We're going to make her a hot one.
Right.
And then she kind of comes and steals the thunder and steals the spotlight a little bit. And so it's very similar in plot. And then Mean Girls is kind of the same thing. There's three, you know, popular girls. There's the outside new girl, Katie, from Africa. So they're all way too similar, I think.
Heather's and Mean Girls, the outsider is the main character, right? I mean, is the sort of protagonist of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Katie is the protagonist, and I would say Veronica is, sure. Yeah.
So,
sure.
But in Clueless, Alicia Silverstone's character was like the central character, right?
Right. Right.
Oh, and Clueless is a retelling of like Emma.
It's Emma. Correct.
Okay.
So it's interesting. I think a lot of people are going to kind of say the been there, done that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to, I mean, I don't know. There is a factor of like, didn't I just kind of see this?
There's also the worst part of it, which was in the articles that I was reading. It's being adapted by Amy Heckerling, who wrote and directed the film. So she's writing the book for the musical.
Oh.
And the score consists of parody versions of 90s pop songs that will turn into monologues and songs for the heartfelt teenagers. Just the pull quote from the article was like, this is a cash grab, and here we're going to tell you flat out.
So
like, we're doing as little work as possible to make this show happen.
So there's no composer, per se.
No, it's like, we're going to sing Bye Bye Bye, but it's going to be like, shop, 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 or whatever. It's going to be rough. I don't love that. I mean, Cruel Intentions just did that off-Broadway not long ago.
Uh-huh.
There was a musical version of Cruel Intentions, the film with Sarah Michelle Gellar, which is Dangerous Liaisons, and they used 90s pop songs as the score. So It's been done already.
I'm also always a little wary when it's a person from the outside, like, you know, I don't know if Amy Heckerling's ever created a musical before.
But from the article, it didn't look like it.
But I'm always skeptical when it's someone from outside the form coming in and doing it.
I'm not as skeptical when someone's coming from the outside the form to do it when they're doing it. But when you're coming in from outside and saying, well, we'll just, you know, pick some songs from other people and just kind of make it into something.
Yeah, well,
feels icky.
It depends on, I guess, who the director is. Because if maybe there's a director that can really shape it, like, not that she would do this, but it seems like the people that like SpongeBob, I think it's probably saved by Tina Landau being the sort of vision behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can at least say that she's coming in with a directorly vision. Like, you could pitch SpongeBob in a way that sounds really unappealing, which is like, it's pop people writing songs for a TV property.
Right.
But if you have Tina Landau, who's kind of like, Tina Landau's like this like kind of like artsy director. She was part of the like Viewpoints movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she bases a lot of stuff on like improvisational concepts, like a very odd at first choice to do SpongeBob. So maybe if they have somebody like that for Clueless, someone with a strong vision.
Mm-hmm. It's still, I mean, honestly, it still feels lazy to me to not write an original score.
Well, how do you feel about Bullets Over Broadway?
That's exactly what I was going to go to. When they first announced Bullets Over Broadway was coming as a musical, I was like, oh, I'm interested in that. That sounds interesting. I hadn't seen the film, but I was familiar with the property, and I thought, this is a great idea. And then they announced it will not have an original score, and I didn't bother to see it.
Yeah, because I think Woody Allen didn't want an original score or something like that. I actually enjoyed Bullets Over Broadway.
Right, but that also had Susan Stroman at the hilt.
Well, so similarly, like, you basically had somebody with enough of a vision to give that show enough moments in it.
But it flopped, so.
Yeah, but I'm saying it was a good show. Oh. Like, when I saw it, I thought it was good.
Oh.
But I remember thinking that, I remember not being sure if the songs were new or not. Like, when I saw American Psycho had original music, but then also would have like a Huey Lewis song in the middle.
In the Air Tonight from Phil Collins.
So when I saw Bullets Over Broadway, I remember, like, you know, I know Let's Misbehave is an old song, but I never heard of a song called the Hot Dog Song before, which was like a bit song that one of the girls did. And it was an old song. Like, then I found out afterwards, like, oh, these are all, but some of the songs like almost fit in a way. But the dance in Bullets Over Broadway is good enough, and also there was like some brilliant work from like Brooks Ismaniskas and the other, basically like a lot of people a lot of the Broadway veterans that were in Bolts for Broadway like did really good work in it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could pull that off with Clueless, I guess. I haven't seen Clueless in like since it was out.
Well, there's the other thing about Clueless that I was thinking about as I was like, you know, it's because it's been a really long time since I've seen it. But she ends up with her brother at the end of the show.
Half brother, right?
Half still.
Well, it's Paul Rudd.
Still. Like, is the, why are we okay with that? Like, oh, she's gonna fuck her brother. That's wonderful. I'm so happy for them, those crazy kids.
Yeah.
It's a little creepy.
I guess.
And he's also significantly older than her.
Oh, is he?
Isn't he?
She's in high school and he's like in college?
She's a senior in high school and I think he's already out of college because he's like interning at the father's law firm.
Yeah, I don't know. I also don't... Well, so did Amy Heckerling direct it?
Yeah.
So did she write it too? Yeah. So this is just maybe like... So this is probably not someone from outside being like, we have to have Clueless the musical. This is her being like, I guess I'll do it.
Well, that's the thing, though. It feels like, oh, well, Tina Fey did it, so why don't I?
Yeah.
Like, that's what it feels like. It feels like, well, I'm not doing anything, so let's go make some money on Broadway.
I mean, I guess there are other...
And it's also off-Broadway, but...
There's other genres, I guess, that have, like, multiple... I'm trying to think of, like, if there's sort of, like, musicals that sit in the same narrative realm as each other, you know? But I don't know. Although there are, like, four Phantoms...
Sure. I mean, that's different takes on the same story or variations of the same.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm saying is like the maybe they see. So, yes, it's definitely it sounds like a cash grab, but like maybe cash grabs are happening like all the time.
Oh, they are.
Genre wise.
Oh, yeah, they absolutely are. I think Clueless is going to suffer from being compared to Mean Girls and Heathers.
Well, and we're not even I mean, it's not like Heathers and Mean Girls are like giant hits either.
No. They weren't. I mean,
Heather's the jury's out on Mean Girls, obviously, but,
you know. Well, I mean, it didn't do very well with the Tonys.
Yeah.
And from most people I know who've seen it have not enjoyed it.
I mean, Heather's, I think, I think Heather's is a very enjoyable musical.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't seem like it was a success.
It wasn't. It really didn't do all that well.
And not technically Broadway.
Right. There was talk of it transferring to Broadway when it closed. There was talk of a film version. There was talk of it coming back to off-Broadway, none of which has happened.
Right.
So, honestly, I mean, if I were the producers of Heathers or the people kind of overseeing the guidance of where Heathers is going, I wouldn't want to bring it back to Broadway right now anyway. Because it's a bad time for it. I opposite with Mean Girls already running and all that, I wouldn't want the comparison. Regardless, I mean... From at least in my opinion, Heathers is a far stronger show.
Heathers at this point, maybe you should focus on like some strong regional productions and getting licensing,
which it's running all over the place.
Yeah, so that's probably the life of it. And then maybe like 10 years from now, a West End production shows up or something.
There you go.
So. Any other new Broadway news for us?
Not really. It's, I mean, post, as we're going into summer, you know, the post kind of Tony slump is happening. The one thing I will say that's kind of surprising is that there haven't been a lot of shows that have posted, or actually, as far as I can see, none of the shows have posted yet.
So sometimes they like hold out to the Tonys to see if they won anything.
Mm-hmm. And then that Monday
and
after.
And then when they don't, they're like, we're dead.
Up go the closing notices.
And nobody's done that.
No, I mean, Escape to Margaritaville, Escape from Margaritaville?
Escape to which Margaritaville? And then Escape from the Planet of the Margaritaville.
Right. Posted before the Tonys because it didn't get any nominations or barely anything. So it's closing July 1st. But nothing else has really
Well, they posted. Did say in the awards, they said that it was the most tickets ever sold ever in a season.
It was the biggest season.
Which seemed hard to believe.
Yeah.
But I guess it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't lie about it.
We hope. The thing about New York and Broadway right now, though, is if you look at it, there are, the war horses, the real, like, tried and true, the Mormons, the Wickeds, the Phantoms, the Hamiltons. I mean, those are running, Lion King even, they're running at huge capacity still. Yeah. They're selling thousands of tickets a week. So there's no sign of them slowing down.
I wonder if there's a halo effect from the Hamilton like fervor of just kids 12 to 20 just getting interested in Broadway at all.
Absolutely.
So like because actually on one of my podcasts today, they were complaining about how hard it was to get Evan Hansen tickets for mm-hmm. Amundsen. And like they were on the podcast, they were saying like, I understand it's hard to get tickets for Hamilton, but it shouldn't be this hard to get tickets for, you know, the next show. Like the, if you've essentially like minted a whole new batch of Broadway fans mm-hmm. and 1 year they're dying to see Hamilton, the next year they want to see something else. Mm-hmm. And so,
hopefully.
Well, but it seems like, it definitely seemed like the next year, a lot of that attention was transferred to Hansen. Mm-hmm. And then maybe there's just like a whole new batch of people that just want to go to New York in the summer and like got introduced to going to Broadway because of the Hamilton like bump.
Sure. But I feel like there are a lot of people who would say Book of Mormon did the same thing, because a lot of people came into Book of Mormon knowing Trey Parker and Matt Stone.
Yeah, but Book of Mormon,
I like South Park, so I'm gonna go see this show. Oh my god, I love this, let's go see something else.
Well, the only thing I would say is I think Book of Mormon, if you saw Book of Mormon as your first show and then you went to see something else, that's a very different tone.
Yeah.
And also I think that Hamilton was a thing that like everybody's nieces and nephews got into. Mm-hmm. Like everybody's friends' kids who are like 11 years old can do all of like the cabinet battles.
Yeah.
And that's something that I don't think Mormon ever got to.
No, definitely not. And also, I mean,
and certainly just, Gentleman's Guide never got to.
No. the push and the just the sheer saturation into pop culture of what Hamilton did.
Yeah, like Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
Was like the Hamilton show for a while. I mean,
but also there are jokes happening on sitcoms.
Yeah.
Constantly. There are, you know, NPR talks about it all the time. It's like, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
So
and now those kids are seeing Wicked. Mm-hmm. Which is just as good.
It is just as good.
Just as long, maybe. What's longer, Hamilton or Wicked?
I honestly don't know.
Hamilton, pretty long.
Running times on either. Probably Hamilton.
Oh, I just bought tickets for us to go see two very short shows in New York.
Yay.
Once on This Island and The Band's Visit are both 90 minutes with no intermission.
Keep them in their seats.
Well, which works great for us, for our scheduling. Mm-hmm. But I was just surprised. I don't know. I mean, I don't mind that idea.
No.
Sounds good to me.
Right? I mean, a lot of times that'll happen to a show that's in trouble.
Yeah, like certain shows that we have seen where you were like, the reason there's no intermission is so that people can't leave.
Well, that's what happened with Passion. Sondheim's Passion was originally a two-act musical, and people weren't coming back.
Oh.
So they cut the intermission, and people were still leaving.
Speaking of shows that I thought were done at intermission... This week we saw Color Purple because I've seen the movie. You have not seen the movie.
I've not.
As far as I can recall, the plot elements in the second act of the musical Color Purple, I don't remember them at all in the movie. Now, maybe I've just blocked them all out. Mm-hmm. But when we got to the intermission, I was like, this is basically done. The story's done. Mm-hmm.
Kind of funny story. When I was 13, my mother took a bunch of her ballet students to New York because we were all living in New Hampshire. So it was like a 3 and a 4 hour drive. So I went with them and we went to go see three shows over the course of a weekend. So we were going to go. We saw Cats. We saw Jerome Robbins Broadway. And then the third show on the Sunday, we were going to see A Chorus Line, not realizing that their schedule had changed and Sundays were no longer part of their schedule. Ah. So we were scrambling like, oh, we have room for one more show. So we went to see Into the Woods, the original production. That's how I saw Into the Woods the first time, which changed my life. But at the end of Act One, everyone was like, that's it, right? Because they were like, happy ever after, so it's over. So we almost left.
The fact that there was no curtain call didn't like tip you off?
Right. But we were all like, I guess it's over. And the only reason we stayed is because I had the cassette of Into the Woods. And I'm like, Snow White is in this show somewhere. I remember seeing Snow White in a picture. So there's more. And then so we stick around and we saw Act Two.
Wait, you had the cassette tape but had never listened to it?
I'd listened to like the first two songs and I did not like it. I was like, all it is just Into the Woods, over and over again.
Into the Words. As Gerardo, what's his name, would say.
Gerardo?
Gerardo Alessandrini.
Gerardo Alessandrini.
Anyway, Let's talk about Color Purple.
Let's talk about Color Purple.
Since I brought it up.
Yes. This production, I went into really hoping it would change my opinion on the show, and it did not.
It's a great cast, I will say.
Really, really great cast.
Probably the most talented touring cast that I've seen, and the only one close to it's probably the Fun Home cast that we saw.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like,
they were great.
I mean, pretty impeccable. Like, I don't have any issue with any of their, like I thought their singing and acting was great.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all around.
Mm-hmm. The only, I thought the Shug was a little stiff here and there, but otherwise she was fine.
Yeah, I thought
she was... the Sophia was great. The Celia was great. The Mister was great.
So just to start with, I feel like they were done a little bit of a disservice by the mixing of the sound in the Pantages.
Agreed.
Now, the Pantages is a theater in Los Angeles where we live that we go see. This is like the main touring house for shows that come through, except for, I guess, when they're prestigious, then they go to the Amundsen because Evan Hansen is going there. And that's where Fun Home went.
And Falsettos is going there, too.
Yeah. So the problem with Pantages is the quality of the sound mix. It really varies. And it's really dependent on the touring sound engineers. It's really different from one show to the next. So I thought that it sounded like perfectly like harmless, but it never felt like the sound got to us. Like
it didn't like shake you. It didn't hit you in a way like that wall of sound can be such an emotional experience.
Yes.
And it was not. And you could tell that cast was singing their faces off.
Yeah.
They were just belting their faces off and we couldn't hear them.
And by the way, we're in row Q because we're
Center
season
Orchestra
ticket subscribers because we're ballers
and fancy.
So and that's not that far. That's like, no, you know, 20 rows back or something.
Yeah. And I mean, I have very good hearing and I was really missing a lot of the lyrics, missing a lot of the, just it wasn't loud enough.
Is also a record number of people at intermission, picking up headsets, like, and not like senior citizens,
listening devices.
Yeah.
Right.
Not like just old people. Like there were some like 20-year-olds,
yeah,
like getting headsets.
And me, I went to go say something to one of the staff at the Pantages, like, hey, the mix is really off. We can't hear. And she was like, oh, okay, well, thanks for letting me know. And I'm like, look at the line. Like, look at the line for listening devices. People who have problems hearing know that before they go into a show. There are 30 people in your line right now at intermission.
Yeah, if you're an elderly person that needs a listening device, that's the first thing you go to. Is you go pick up your listening device right before the show starts. Then you go to where?
The ladies' room.
Then your ladies' room. And then you go buy all the candies and you wait to unwrap them until the middle of act two.
Oh my God, those people behind us.
Yes. Unfortunately, so we had the two of the rudest people behind us the whole time.
Well, first of all, through all of act one, she was talking about how she couldn't see. And she was behind you. So, like, it's not like I was big and gigantic in front of her.
But then they switched.
And then they switched, and she still talked how she couldn't see. And then she had the trash bag full of the noisiest candies.
Well, here's the issue. You can have candies. First of all, you're supposed to unwrap them before the show starts, even though they didn't say that. But everybody knows that. You unwrap candies. To the point that it's a joke now in pre-show speeches. If it had just been the candies, that would have been mildly annoying, but, like, intermittent. However, she kept them in a, like, CVS bag that was much louder than the candy bag.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why she didn't just take the candies and just put them on her lap. She was putting them back in or in taking them out.
Yep. And it seemed like she was waiting for the quietest moments.
Yes. And there's a lot of very quiet moments in Color Purple.
Yeah. And like four cell phones went off during the duration.
Yeah. It's one of the rudest really audiences that we've been a part of. So I felt the cast, which was like, they were really just giving their all. I felt they were done a disservice by the sound mix.
Mm-hmm.
I
thought they were done a disservice by the score.
The score is, yeah, like, it's yeah, I don't know what to say about it, really. Like, I really admire the people that were up on stage. I thought they were really, it's almost like, if they're giving their all, then, like, it's hard for me to be mad at the show.
Well, I mean, going back, I saw the original production twice.
Yeah.
I never saw LaShawn's. She was out both times I saw it. The first time I saw it, I saw her understudy. I think it was still in previews. And I remember thinking, I don't like this show. Like, the score is not strong. The book is confusing. Like, I remember very clearly at one point she's like, Harpo, get out of here. You're 6 years old. Harpo, you're engaged? Like 3 seconds later. And I was like, what? Just like we just
jumped. Did they change that?
Kind of. I don't know if it was done differently or if I remember her, like she came forward at one point during the revival and was like narrating for a moment. And that's around the place where I was like, wait, we just jumped 13 years and I don't
there was a point yeah.
notice of it.
There were a couple of time jumps that were very abrupt. And, you know, it's funny, time jumps that didn't, I don't know, they didn't really matter that much, but then they were kind of distracting.
Right.
It was when, like, you've been living together for 3 years. It's like, okay, I guess so.
Yeah, like, oh, thanks for letting us know. So I think the book is muddled. I think the score is not really great. She does not, Celie does not have a strong I want song at the beginning of the show, which is what's really important, I think, for a protagonist in a musical, is you need to know what they want. And she... I think the thing about Celie and the thing that's hard to musicalize about The Color Purple is that a lot of things happen to Celie, but she doesn't really do much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's kind of a passive character that just a lot of shit happens to.
But I think that's why the second act of the show is, of this show, is written in a way to, in my opinion, it became a little too Designing Women for me, where I think they did give her agency in the second act. I think that's a good thing, but I think that the way... I will say this one choice I didn't like. The way she played her in the second act kind of became...
Julia Sugarbaker.
Julia Sugarbaker, but also a little bit sociopathic.
Yeah, right?
Like, she was very cold in a way that is probably like... That probably is what happens to you when you have the brutal, like, upbringing that she did. But it was very, like, Terminator 2 kind of. So I didn't love that. And also, I just didn't... In general, I don't love when characters just give rousing lectures to other characters, which I felt like it was like Designing Women.
And but that you know what? The night the lights went out in Georgia.
But lots of people love Designing Women.
Sure.
Including, I bet, most people in that audience because they love that show.
Right. I used to call Designing Women, let's see what Julia's bitching about this week.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the first time I saw LaChance's understudy, and then I went back to see the show the second time, the original production, because everyone had talked about how incredible Fantasia Barrino was from American Idol in the role. So I went back to see the show again. Still didn't like the show, liked it better.
How's Fantasia?
She was great.
I love her.
She was great. I was really surprised at how great she was. She brought a real connection and emotional depth to the character that I hadn't seen from the understudy the first time around. But I still didn't love the show. I still felt the show was just kind of disconnected and disjointed, and the score wasn't very good.
I think it's a good vehicle for talented performers. Because a lot of people have songs in it.
Yeah.
There's a song in the second act that I was like, this does not need to be in here at all.
Oh, Mr. Song?
Yeah, it was a great song, and he has a great voice.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
But I was like, this is not... I don't care about this dude's story at this point in the narrative. It functioned in a way that it gave Celie's story time to progress by her sort of being away.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of redemption that Mister gets at the end, I think you can achieve just through his acting, and you don't need the song for him to be like... It just put him... It gave him a centrality to the storyline that I did not think he deserved or that the audience wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I will say that the issues that are in Color Purple and the sort of like the themes that it represents don't particularly resonate with me or probably you.
Mm.
So like I think a lot of people that are like parents or like, you know, like there's a lot of things in it that I know people just like start crying at immediately whenever they see that show because the friends of mine saw it and they started crying, you know?
Yeah. My mother absolutely adored the show. She wept openly during it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I didn't see her with
that. I think there's certain, like, if you're a parent, probably the idea of having two kids and giving them up makes you connect to the story right from the start. And that probably does a fair amount of work right away that can help you sort of patch over, like, the fact. And the fact that it doesn't reach us is where if the script was better... You know, or the score was better. It would reach people that even didn't relate to the core.
Yeah, right.
Because then the score and stuff would be like, it's like if the songs are evocative or even, I hate to say it, like, but catchy, if they are, if you connect with the score musically, it can be a way for you to relate to the themes of the characters. Mm-hmm. Because, like, it's like, oh, I get this song, so I must get this character too, in a way. It's almost like kind of not fooling you, but like it's another way in to relating to the character.
Right.
And this score, I think we both agree, did not feel very relatable.
No. And there's also that glaring issue in the middle of
There's one song in the middle of it. Oh, I will say I don't like the way that it soft-pedaled the
lesbian relationship.
No, I didn't like that at all.
I will say that this revival in general, having
soft-pedaled everything.
Yeah, having seen the original production, it felt less violent, it felt less scary, it felt less everything. It, like, I kind of equate it to the color palette of the set and the costumes. This was the color beige. Mm-hmm. This wasn't the color purple, because everything was muted. Everything felt kind of underplayed. And even Hell No, like, which is a big number of Sophia finally, like, no, this isn't going to happen. In the original production, I remember the audience going nuts. And they enjoyed it here, but it was not the same kind mm-hmm. of powerful moment that the original production had. Everything just felt kind of understated.
Do we know who directed the original?
That was Gary Griffin? Gary?
Yes, it was Gary
something. And then
I was going to say Gary Marshall?
No, Gary Griffin. And then John Doyle directed this version.
I don't know the ethnicity of Gary Griffin, but
I believe he's Asian.
Oh, yeah? Well, then so I'm all
now
for
you'll
it.
Love it.
No, I was going to say, like, I don't love the fact that I think I asked you this. I don't get why Marsha Norman had to write the book for this show. Mm. I know that she's an accomplished, obviously she's an accomplished playwright, and she wrote other great shows such as Bridges of Madison County and Secret Garden, which you like. But I did not like John Doyle's direction for this show.
No.
And also I would like to have an African American person, a woman. How about an African American woman direct this show? Mm-hmm. Like, how about we find one?
Mm-hmm. Oprah.
Sure, have Oprah do it.
So, I mean, she produced the original production.
But, like, I don't know. I just, it's such a centrally African American story mm-hmm. that I think that I would like to have. I don't know. I guess I wouldn't be saying that if I love the direction of the show. So
right.
I don't know if I'm right about this, but.
I do want to go back real quick because we started down the path about that song.
Oh, yes. What's that song actually called? Like,
What About Love? So it's the big duet, the big love song between Suge and Seeley. And I remember sitting in the audience the first time I heard it and going, wait a minute.
This sounds like something.
This is an All for One song
mm-hmm.
because it, I mean, the progression is exactly the same. Like, it sounds exactly like it. And yeah. I don't understand.
I thought that too. And I don't think you had told me that.
No.
Cause at the intermission, I was like, it kind of sounds like,
cause it's like, I want you to be a story for me that I can believe in forever.
Beat of my heart.
And I swear.
Yeah.
For better or worse, till death do us part, I love you with every beat of my... It's the same song.
I remember in the original kid... What is it? For better or worse, to death do us part. Like, he had, like, the vowel sound he ended up on. I will point out, I'm pretty sure it's true that that song was then covered by John Michael Montgomery, country singer. And he did, or I think that might be his song.
And so, they covered it?
Because there's another song that he did called I Can Love You Like That, that mm-hmm. they covered.
Oh.
One of them is, so they swapped. They both covered each other's songs.
That's lovely.
I remember, I feel like two of the band was cute.
Hmm.
In my opinion.
Anyway, back to the musical theater.
Oh, yeah. Let's not talk about homosexual things. Let's talk about musical theater.
Exactly. Thank you. One other thing that I found interesting, differences between the original production and this production. In this production, by the end of the show, Seeley kind of still seemed like she was in her 30s.
Oh.
And in the original production, Fantasia was 178,000 years old at the end of that show. She was talking like this, and she had a gray wig on, and she was...
Oh.
So it was really interesting, because I'm like, we're covering the same amount of time. Like, we know that at least 30 or 40 years has gone past... Or have gone by at this point.
So she's probably, what, like 11, 12 when it starts? And she's probably 50 by the end?
I think she's like in her 60s or 70s by the end of the play.
Yeah, because she's sort of run this company for like a long time.
Right.
It's weird. She actually has basically become Oprah by the end of this. That's, I swear that the movie does not have any of that like industrious second part of the story in it.
Miss Seeley's pants?
No, I don't remember that at all.
I love that moment when Suge left to go sleep with a 19-year-old, and then she came back, which is supposed to be months later.
Yes, yes.
And they're like, ooh, Suge looked good. I'm like, she's wearing exactly what she was wearing when she left.
Yes.
She didn't change at all.
Yeah, that was weird. Like, Suge looks good. It's like, that's the same wardrobe.
We just saw her.
I will say that I think that production felt cheap to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was like three panels of wood and some chairs. That's all it was.
I actually thought the initial tableau of the back part of the stage and the chairs, like sort of all attached to it, I thought that was very nice and evocative. And I actually thought it brought to mind for me images of like the generations and like who are the other people that have sat in these rocking chairs over the years. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very interesting all the way through the whole first like church song. And then like that stuff just like sat there the rest of the show. Mm-hmm. Like nothing happened. And it actually reminded me of like Texas State one act play contest. Mm-hmm. Because they were kind of doing staging that we would do in one act play contest, which is like we have chairs and we just use different parts of the, like it felt very like I walked down this platform and that's a wall. Like, so I've now walked into the room. There were a lot of scenes where it was like, these people couldn't hear each other because mm-hmm. they'd be on one side or the other. And it's like, yeah, but there's no stage. Like it didn't feel amateurish, but it felt cheap. Mm-hmm. It felt frugal.
And if one more person folded laundry, I was going to scream.
Oh, I like
there was so much like foldography.
A lot of baskets in general.
Yeah. The other, I know this is terrible, but the other problem I've always had with that show is thank God she found that letter first. Thank God she found the exposition later where it's like, hey, it's been 9 years. I know that you think I'm dead. I'm not. I'm in Africa. I've got your two kids. Mister's probably beating you. Mister's been hiding your letters, but I'm not dead.
Well, I will say this makes me want to read the book again because I actually want to read. I have read the book a long time ago. And I'd like to read the book again because I want to see what letter she gets first in the book.
Uh-huh.
Because, first of all, I can't believe Alice Walker would write it that way.
Right.
Because the idea that Nettie is, like, writing letters and every letter she's like, P.S., I'm still not dead.
Right. Well, no shit. Who wrote the letter?
Yeah.
There's that.
Dear Seeley.
I'm not dead.
Like, the first sentence of every letter is, I'm not dead. Yeah. Do you think that show's worth seeing if it's coming to town for podcast listeners?
The Color Purple?
Yeah.
First
of all, I think if you like the movie, it's worth seeing.
Yeah. I don't think it's not worth seeing. I think anything is worth seeing, generally.
Well, that's not a very robust recommendation.
Well,
you know
what?
I think a piece of garbage on the street's worth seeing. So,
well, in all honesty, I don't really want to give it a robust, like, go see it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I will say that this show has connected with a lot of people I care about way deeper than it connected with me. So
yeah.
It could just be it's not my story. It's not the story that I feel emotionally connected to, but I think looking at it as a piece of theater, it's clunky and it's not well written. It's just not well written.
Yeah. I think sometimes, and this can connect to the other show we're going to talk about today, I think sometimes a show like this might feel more valuable to people when it's like there aren't a lot of other shows that talk about the same thing. So speaking of which, the other show that we saw recently was Soft Power at the Amundsen. And so, like, I've run into friends. Soft Power is a play with a musical, is the official tagline, which I think is a very accurate.
Very accurate but very confusing structure.
Yeah, I don't think it's that confusing, but I don't think it's that confusing. I also don't think it's as interesting as it thinks it is or as effective, but I don't think the actual structure is that confusing.
No.
But it's basically a play by David Henry Hwang about a playwright named David Henry Hwang who is sort of commissioned by this Hong Kong producer to write, I guess, a TV show? Like a...
Mm-hmm. Celebrating the wonders of China.
Yeah. And then... and also the wonders of, like, sticking with your life and not abandoning it, like in a very non-American way, not chasing your dreams, basically. And then he goes, a little, something happens to him, which is kind of knocks him off kilter. And there's a sort of like,
which, I mean, if you know the news, it actually happened to him. So it's,
well, we'll let it be.
Sure.
So then it, so he has a little bit of fantasia where, and not a burrito, a real one, where he sort of has a vision of a musical that happens that is like sort of a play off of King and I, but basically like, what if Chinese people wrote a musical about America? And that music is provided by Janine Tesori.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of the middle part of the show is a musical.
Right. And it's, I mean, it's interesting. I don't think it was a successful show. I don't think it was, I feel like such a negative person because I don't like anything. Hmm. I do like shows, I promise. I do like shows, I promise. But I feel
You don't dislike this show.
I didn't dislike it. I thought it was admirable. I thought it had a really strong point of view. I thought it had a really strong voice. I just think the structure was weird. And I think that I didn't love the music, most of it. And I felt like the premise of the middle section was very strange in the given current political climate.
Oh, why?
It just felt weird to have like Hillary Clinton doing a tap dance. I just felt strange.
Oh, watching. So I didn't have a problem with that. So Hillary Clinton is a character in the show because the main character has an opportunity to meet her at a fundraiser. And then she sort of appears in the musical part of the show. So speaking of like things where you relate to things that are happening on stage, and this is why I made that segue, which is like there isn't another show that talks about anything like this or has other characters like this.
Absolutely agreed.
You know, like I would say the number of large, high production value shows that even have Asian actors portraying modern Asian people is 0 to 1. Like how many are there?
Yeah, I honestly can't think of one. I really can't, because it's like
they're always like it's Flower Drum Song,
it's King and I. Yeah, it's Miss Saigon.
Even Allegiance is like not about, you know,
it's set in the '40s. Yeah,
it's not about people today,
right?
So I see all of the flaws of this show, but like there's a part of me that's like, well, there isn't another show like that's better than this at telling this particular story.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually don't think the structure is that confusing. I actually think that, I do think that the music's not pleasing enough.
Mm-hmm.
Although it has really good moments in it, but it's also sort of still a work in progress, I will say. They're going to San Francisco next to work on it more.
Right. I guess I kind of feel the way you felt about Color Purple, in that if you're telling this story from this point of view, why didn't we get an Asian composer?
I would agree with that.
Because it's like, this is supposed to be from an Asian point of view. Mm-hmm. The whole point of the show is, when they look at The King and I, they talk about how, why are the people who are in the country where it's set being being shown as the foreigners?
So
because we always have a way in with a white person going in, saying like, oh, well, we relate to her, so isn't this crazy, all these weird people, but we're going to relate to them because she's relating to them.
So the reason I would excuse it here is that this is David Henry Hwang's project. Like, it's his story, and he's the one who, like, initiated the whole project. Mm-hmm. So there is a part of me that's like, and also, when it comes to, like, keeping an eye on, like, appropriation or representation, I'm comfortable having him be the cop on his own project, since he has been quite a cop on that issue,
sure,
over the years. So I'm just saying, like, that softens a little bit because he basically hired her to be on the project.
Right. I'm not saying it from a political standpoint or even from a PC standpoint. I'm saying it from the sound of the music. The music should have sounded more like it was composed by an Asian person.
But that doesn't really mean anything.
I guess. I don't know.
The problem is that doesn't really have
maybe
a meaning.
Yeah. I guess maybe sound more traditional, or I don't know. I don't know. It felt like,
I don't think
here's Janine Tesori writing some songs.
Yeah. But the thing is that my issue is that the music wasn't catchy enough.
Right.
So.
But like the big production number for Hillary Clinton when she's trying to get all the votes, and then the big production number that happens in the White House, which is covered in Budweiser branding, mm-hmm, for Trump, those felt like pastiche of Broadway songs or like pastiche of a Broadway musical, and it didn't feel like
it, I think that's what they were.
Right. But what I'm saying is like in The King and I, or what they were trying to go for is that why do the mainlanders feel like they're being portrayed as foreigners? So in this, if you're going to reverse that, then why does it sound like it didn't? I don't think that's
not my issue with it, because I think that the whole thing's happening in David Henry Hwang's head.
Right.
So it is a pastiche of what he knows about musicals. And actually my issue is that it should have been a more effective version of a Broadway musical in those moments, because the numbers that were supposed to be showstoppers were not really showstoppers.
No, not at all.
So I don't think if there was an Asian, like if there was a Chinese composer composing in a more Chinese traditional or even modern day Chinese compositional mode, which I'm not even sure what that would sound like, I think that would turn the show into an intellectual exercise that people would be like, oh, I see what they're doing. They're telling American stereotypical stories in a Chinese mode of music.
That's what I was trying to say.
But I think the audience would be like, I don't like this. Like, I don't think that. I think that would be a purely intellectual, like, I'm clever for getting that. That's what they did.
Uh-huh.
But I think they...
But I still don't find this pleasing.
Yeah. I think they genuinely wanted the middle of the show to be like, you love this show as much as you love Oklahoma.
Mm.
And so I actually think it was just not that successful at that on those terms, and could have been more so. Because I thought that... So, like, you should have come out of the middle of that show with, like, 4 or 5 tunes in your head. Of just like, oh my god, that one number was incredible. And like, so basically if you had, like, it's almost like you needed Sarah Bareilles to compose the middle of it or something. Because like hooks and hooks and hooks.
Right.
So that like, if you had a number like when we saw Waitress and like Augie's number, which just like brought the house down, and which on further listens on like cast recording is like, oh, this is just, it's okay. But something about, if you had those moments in the musical part that were like, that was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to reckon with the political things that they were saying. I think that would be interesting.
Right. Yeah. The catchiness and the pleasing nature of the song would pull you in and hook you. And then you would get into the depth of it.
And also that would fulfill the sort of thesis of the entire show, which is that Broadway musicals are a delivery system for community, like transferring ideologies. And actually the title of the show is Soft Power, the idea that like you can sort of change cultures or change people's opinions of a culture through soft ways of like getting them to see you differently through like art and other things.
Mm-hmm.
So if the thesis of the show is China wants to like change its image by like creating a really different like vision of itself through like a popular TV series or a musical or something, then I wanted this show to be also an example of effective delivery system.
Right.
And it just wasn't. Yeah.
Right.
But I think that it could be like, it probably is. It depends on how aggressively they're going to revise it.
Mm-hmm. I will say I did feel the top of Act 2 was really strange.
Oh, I love that. That's
the talk
favorite.
Show.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
I felt it was weird when the show that I'm watching is telling me how important the show that I'm watching is, because that's what it was doing.
I like that. That actually, there's actually a scene just like that in a theater complicité show called Mnemonic. That there's an extended like series scene like that, and it reminded me of that, and I liked it. That I didn't mind. I would say some of the devices in this show felt almost like Sondheim-y in terms, or like, yeah, like felt kind of Sondheim-y in the way that it sort of commented on itself a lot. So I thought that was fine.
I guess you've
seen that in other shows before.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, I don't know. The Clinton number and the Trump in the White House number.
Well, yeah, that was actually Pence, wasn't it?
Was it Pence? Oh, you're right. It was Pence. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. It was Pence. Trump was not actually in the show. Thank God. They both, I don't know, like they felt garish to me.
Yeah.
They felt ugly. They felt cheap. They felt tacky.
Well, that's like, what I mean. If you could replace those two numbers with great versions of those numbers.
Yeah. I think that those two numbers were really problematic for me because it was like, okay, you're telling me this show is important. You're telling me this show is going to change culture. This ain't doing it. Like, this isn't working, and I don't see this being something that the masses latch onto. Like, oh my God, I loved that.
The Clinton number was the one where she was doing all the different, like, she did the dance number and...
Yeah, it was kind of like, it felt like Show Off from Drowsy
Because
Chaperone
I liked... Yeah, it did actually remind me of that a lot.
But not as good.
I liked her number in the, like, boiler room when she was singing about, like... It was after the election, and she was eating cake. I actually liked that moment a lot. Mm. And I thought the last number was really moving, because basically the show is about whether... something we sort of have to think about now is, like, maybe democracy, like, just doesn't work. Like, it might just... Like, we might have been had our hunches. Like, hey, democracy is great, and it's, you know, as they say, it's like... it's the least bad system compared to all the others or whatever. But maybe it's just not. Maybe it's just going to fail. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the show, they kind of had to like deal with like, you know, it was sort of a reaffirmation. However, sort of like not. I wasn't convinced that they totally believed it as people. Mm-hmm. But trying to sort of tell themselves like maybe we'll give democracy one more chance. And we also did see the show on election day here, from the primary election day in mm-hmm. California. And I almost missed voting for the primary. So I felt very glad that I had an I voted sticker on my shirt as they sang a song about democracy. But that last moment,
you're
I thought...
You're welcome.
You know what's funny is that last moment reminded me of Pippin. And I hate the ending of Pippin. I think it's a total cop-out. And
hey,
it's not bad
for a musical comedy. Ta-da!
Didn't mind it here. Because it felt very raw, mm-hmm. and I actually thought that Francis Ju, his acting was like it was effective in service of the show to that point. And at the end, I thought it was very raw and vulnerable, and like I liked the ending of that show a lot. And so like I feel like if they can just make the rest of the show a little leaner and meaner mm-hmm. because I think the ending of it is very powerful. Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like it would be served better to pull out, make them non-actual people, like make it a political figure like Hillary Clinton, make it a political figure like Mike Pence, but being the way the political climate is right now, I don't think people want to see that. I don't think people want to relive what we've been going through.
Oh, I thought it, like...
I don't know. I feel like it felt... Like, again, it felt trashy. It felt gross.
It felt
tabloid-ish.
I think those are more reflective of the quality of those songs than whether or not they used them or not.
Maybe.
Because I think that there was... I think that her moment in the boiler room really resonated because it was Hillary. Mm.
I guess what I will say about like my overall feeling of the show is what I said to you in the car after. It felt like the show itself was greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
Because I felt like it's an important show. It's a point of view that we've not seen before or haven't heard enough from.
Yeah.
And I think looking at the people around us and seeing, cause there was a very high Asian turnout
yeah.
for that particular performance. And I think that that's important. I think it's important for people to see people who look like themselves on stage and who are telling their stories on stage.
Yeah.
And to see an all Asian cast of, like you said, of modern people. It's not, you know, 1700 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and I thought that that's important. I think like that's very important.
I think that what you're saying about the Hillary and Pence stuff is reflective of that, like, this show is not going to, I can't imagine it goes to Broadway. It's not a show written to be like a commercial success. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that the stuff about Clinton and Pence very much like locks it to now. Like, it's a show that, like, is very married to, like, 2018. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's reflective that it's just David Henry Hwang working through his... This is why I admire about it, is it's just theater as a... I'm an artist, and this is what I'm thinking right now. I'm not trying to create, like, a Broadway musical that, like, licenses itself for the next 30 years and makes me rich. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to... Like, I'm not trying to do anything but express what I'm trying to process right now. And if I can have somebody come see that, great. You know, like, there's definitely a place for theater that's, like, that isn't concerned with, you know... Like, there's a lot of things about this show that you need to change for it to be, like, a commercial Broadway musical. Mm-hmm. And so, it's to me, it's worth it to have a show that's just like, eh, I'd rather just explore these things. Like,
it feels like art as a coping device.
Yeah.
As a coping mechanism.
And so, I think this might be one of those shows that, like, 3 years from now is, like, no one's going to produce it anymore because it's, like, not needed or whatever.
Well, I wonder if distance will maybe help it.
I mean, distance, if it's like, if everybody in it is like sort of a historical figure that you don't have any emotionality about.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Once the emotion of, oh my God, we're living through this is detached and is no longer there.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's easier to look at it objectively as a piece of art and just go, okay, this is what happened. And this is a kind of fantasia on that.
Yeah. I think it kind of lives in a, so it wasn't really like an opera, but the parts of it that felt like an opera to me were that I have seen a fair amount of like political operas that sort of live in that space of like, this feels important, but not that enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how it felt. But like, I guess I'm glad that it exists.
Mm-hmm. I will say I like the cast a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had been in it. I think I could have been good at some of those numbers. I think I could have made a couple of those showstopper numbers a little more showstoppering.
Uh-huh. Sure. I'm sure you could have.
Okay.
No, I'm sure you... I was more silent on the word issue is that you're having. Stoppering.
So, what do we have next to see?
We have The Humans coming up.
Oh, yes. Humans with almost the entire original cast from New York City, which... wait, you didn't see?
I have not seen.
Oh, I saw that. Why was I there by myself? I don't remember.
Was that the same trip when you saw American Psycho or no? No, that would have...
Oh, no, I think that I was in New York a day longer than you or a day shorter than... Like, I was either there before you or after you when we saw Waitress.
Oh.
And then I saw...
She loves me.
Because this is like DCM related.
Oh.
There was one time I think I was there an extra day and I saw Humans.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, Humans is coming to LA.
So we have that coming up. We have that Temptations musical.
That's not till October.
It's coming up.
Because that replaces the other Amundsen ticket that was supposed to be Crazy for You.
Right.
And what's happening with that? Is that gone?
I've not heard anything further on Crazy for You. We had heard that it was part of our season, and then I'd heard that it was pulled from our season because it was going straight to Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And that's the last I heard. I love Crazy for You. I'm very excited to see it again. It's a show that I thought I was going to hate. I was really sure going into it that I was going to hate.
Did you see it on Broadway?
I saw the national tour.
I saw the original with Harry Grainer.
Uh-huh.
Is that his name?
Grainer, yeah.
Yeah.
From Dear John. Remember that show?
Uh-huh.
I don't remember who I saw as the male, but I saw Karen Ziemba as Polly, the Jodie Benson role.
Oh.
Prior to Steel Pier and her becoming a Tony-winning actress and all that.
So who was supposed to be in this one?
This was going to be Tony Yazbek and Laura Osnes, I believe.
Oh.
And what happened?
Is he related to David Yazbek?
He's not.
That is a very unusual last name to not be.
It isn't. It is. Sorry.
It isn't, actually.
It isn't, actually.
It's very like, common.
It's really common. He went to my high school.
Oh.
Years after I did.
Well, lots of famous people went to your high school.
Well, yeah.
You went to Fame High School in Fametown, USA.
Yeah, I was Leroy.
But now people can contact us. It's week two.
Yeah, we're fancy now. We got a Facebook page.
Eric, how can they contact us?
We have an email address, which is opencallpodcast@gmail.com. We have a Facebook page, which is Open Call. And we are working on a Twitter.
We're working on a Twitter?
I set up a Twitter and... it said, like, put in your birthday. So I put in, like, the day that we launched. And then it immediately locked my account and said, you're under 13. You can't have an account.
Wait, you put it in as 2018?
Yeah. Because I was like, well, that's the day that we launched.
I know. But do you think that Twitter would be like...
It didn't occur to me. Well, because we were doing... I was doing not a personal account. I was doing a business account thing or whatever. I didn't think it was going to matter.
But a human being, like, 3 days old.
Right.
Just imagine they immediately got on Twitter.
Right. So I'm like, it was like, you're under 13. And it immediately locked my account. And there's no way to contact them or anything. So I found, like, this email address that I had to send a copy of or a picture of my license to prove that I'm older than 18 or 13 or whatever.
They're like, this is not a three-day-old baby.
Right, like, come on.
This is a man that
so looks... So Twitter is for
this man looks 28 years old.
28 years old in dog years. So yeah, we will have a Twitter coming soon.
Send us an email. Tell us what your favorite musical is.
opencallpodcast@twitter.com.
Oh, great. Tell us what your favorite musical is, as long as it's not Wicked.
Or Legally Blonde or Phantom.
But if your favorite musical is Love Never Dies, please send an email. Because that might be one of my favorite experiences ever.
Oh, God. When you say that was one of your favorite experiences ever, I mean, I'm assuming you're being facetious, but
I mean,
part of me thinks you enjoyed the torture of it.
It wasn't torture at all. I enjoyed it. I straight up enjoyed that show, like, more than The Bodyguard, which was sort of an ironic thing. But, like...
I'm slack-jawed currently.
Because Love Never Dies at least was interesting.
Was it, though? Because it really wasn't to me.
It was to me in ways that most of the things I've seen in The Pentagious have not been.
Mm-hmm.
But we can talk about that another time.
Sure. Love Never Dies, I will say, is not the worst thing I've ever seen. It was close. But it wasn't the worst.
I mean, I would go see Love Never Dies 100 times before I saw Bright Star again. I'll leave it at that.
Absolutely not. I would see Bright Star many, many times. And I didn't love Bright Star.
Can I tell you, if
I would see In My Life again before I saw...
If Bright Star was a baby, I'd put it in a suitcase and throw it off a train. That's all I'll say.
On that note, thank you so much for joining us for Open Call.
We'll see you next week. I'm Chris Grace.
And I'm Eric Michaud.
Bye.
Bye.